All right, so we'll start with Matthew chapter 23, verses 1 through 39. And most of the readings tonight are really lengthy, so we're not going to have time to look at multiple different Gospels. This one starts out with a very lengthy reading in Matthew and just very short readings in Mark and Luke that accompany some of the things that were being discussed in Matthew. But we'll start with Matthew chapter 23, verses 1 through 39. And I think we'll read this one. Let's divide this up in about, if I can get somebody to read verses 1 through 15, somebody 16 through 30, and somebody finish it off then. So start with chapter 23, verses 1 through 15, if somebody wants to read.
And Jesus spoke to the crowds and to his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. Therefore, all that they tell you, do and observe, but do not do according to their deeds, for they say things and do not do them. They tie up heavy burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move them with such much as a finger. But they do all their deeds to be noticed by men, for they broaden their
phylacteries, probably.
There you go. And lengthen the tassels of their garments. They love the place of honor at banquets and the chief seats in the synagogues, and respectful greetings in the marketplaces and being called rabbi by men. But do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher and you are all brothers. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father and he is in heaven. Do not be called leaders, for one is your leader, that is Christ. But the greatest among you shall be your servant. Whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you shut off the kingdom of heaven from people, for you do not enter in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you devour widows' houses, and for pretense you make long prayers, therefore you will receive greater condemnation. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you travel around on sea and land to make one proselyte, and when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves."
Right. 16 through 30.
"Woe to you, blind guides, who say, whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obligated. You fools and blind men, which is more important, the gold or the temple that sanctified the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the offering upon it, he is obligated. You blind men, which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? Therefore, he who swears both by the altar and by everything on it. And he who swears by the temple, swears both by the temple and by him who dwells within it. And he who swears by heaven, swears both by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin, and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. But these are the things that you should have done without neglecting the others. You blind guides, who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you clean the outside of the cup and of the dish, but inside they are full of robbery and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and of the dish, so that the outside of it may become clean also. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside appear beautiful, but inside they are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you too outwardly appear righteous to men, but inwardly you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had been living in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partners with them in shedding the blood of the prophets.
All right, and somebody finish up 31 through 39.
Therefore, you are witnesses against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your father's guilt. Serpents, brood of vipers, how can you escape the condemnation of hell? Therefore, indeed, I send you prophets, wise men, and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Assuredly, I say to you, all these things will come upon the generation. But Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.
All right. So the first question I have for you tonight is, just going, is what did Jesus mean by whatever they tell you do and comply with it all, but do not do as they do, for they say things and do not do them? What does he mean by that?
Keep the law, but don't do what the Pharisees do.
Then what were the Pharisees doing?
Adding stuff all the time.
Mm-hmm. What was more important to them?
Tradition.
Okay. And that's, he hits on tradition a bunch of times in here. He never says the word, but that's exactly what he's referring to. So the scribes and Pharisees read the law in its completeness. He never accused them of being incomplete with the law. And that's what he tells these people. Do exactly what they say to do, but don't do what they do, because they're not fulfilling the law in any way, shape, or form. They're fulfilling their traditions, the traditions that they have set above the law. They read the law. Those scribes know the law to the T, and the things they read to you, dead on. But they're not keeping it. They're not doing it. That's not what they're doing. They're keeping their traditions, not the law. And so he's very forthcoming with that. Jesus warns about obeying the law of God, not the traditions of man. The traditions of men that get set above the law that has been put forth before us. And that's the important part. And even in this day and age, we read the law, right? We read the law that Jesus has set before us. The law of righteousness. The new covenant. Those things are put before men on a regular basis. How many of you see John 3:16 on the back of somebody's bumper on a regular basis? Do they understand what it means?
Probably not.
I'm afraid they don't, because if they did, they'd look at the two verses before and the three verses after and understand the entire context of what's being discussed there. But they don't. They like to pick and choose and cut apart God's word. Carol.
It's not just that they held tradition above God's law. They basically broke God's law in many, many ways.
Oh, absolutely.
Just, they were totally hypocrites. And
they were. And he goes on, he tells you some of the things they were doing. They wanted to be seen by men. The phylacteries, that's the lining, basically, of their robe, you know? So they would broaden there, so it's wider than everybody else's. So they got these huge linings on their robes, so that they stand out from the rest of the people. Okay.
Be seen.
And their tassels, you know, tassels were 6 inches. Well, theirs were a foot. So they got gigantic tassels hanging down to be seen by men, right? So the second question I have for you here is, what did Jesus mean by make one proselyte, and when he has become one, you make him twofold more a son of hell than yourselves. So, proselyte. What's a proselyte?
Converted Gentile to Judaism.
Okay, so is he talking about converted Gentiles to Jews here? And what I want to get at is, I don't think that's exactly what he's talking about. Because there were probably very many righteous Gentiles converted to Jews. But worse was, he's talking about heathen, not heathens converted to worshiping God, but Jews converted to Phariseeism. Converted to the traditions of men. And that they become worse than their teachers, drifting further from the law and more devoted to these men's traditions than their teachers were. And we see that it gets worse and worse and worse as you go. What does that lead to? As they drift away from God's law and in more into the traditions of men, what happens as we go into further into the New Testament? We see more and more persecution. Persecution of Christians. Persecution even of Jews who had converted to Christianity. Because they're straying so far from the law of God that they're applying their traditions in a way that is not even a shadow of what God had taught them in the old law, to say nothing of what Jesus had taught when he was here. So what I see him talking about here is not a proselyte in the definition of the word, but these proselytes who had been proselytized into Phariseeism, into their traditions. Paul claiming what?
He was a Pharisee of Pharisees.
That he was seated at the feet of Gamaliel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? What does that mean? He was a Pharisee. He wasn't a Jew. Right? He was a Jew, of course, but he's not claiming that. He's claiming he was a Pharisee. He was entrenched in the traditions of the Pharisees. And he knew them backwards and forwards. And so that's what I think he's talking about there. So we have to kind of dig into the word sometimes, even in these situations where it looks very straightforward, but I don't think it's exactly straightforward. I think you have to really dig in there to get what he's talking about. And then lastly, why would swearing by the gold of the temple be more important to the Pharisee than the temple itself?
Because that's what they loved.
Exactly.
Yeah.
These Pharisees are obsessed with things that make them stand out to everybody else.
They're materialistic.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely materialistic.
Showy.
And, you know, Jesus accused them of violating the law with korban, which is what?
Dedicated to the Lord so you can't spend it for your parents or widows or whatever.
Exactly. Violating the law to dedicate something to the Lord just so you don't have to spend it on things that you were commanded to spend it on. Supporting the widow, supporting ailing parents, supporting your family, supporting the poor. But no, this is Corbin. All that I have, I've given to God, so I can't give it to anything else. Carol.
Wasn't one of the reasons that they swore by the gold of the temple and by things was that they didn't want to be judged for their vow because they could break that vow because it wasn't swearing by God. But to swear by the gold of the temple meant that they didn't have to worry about God holding it against them.
No, that's exactly the opposite. They said you could swear by the temple, but not by the gold in the temple. Or you could swear by the sacrifice, or you swear by the altar and break that, but you couldn't swear by the sacrifice on the altar.
Right.
Because that would be something you can't violate that. And Jesus points that out and says, you're hypocrites. If you're swearing by the altar, you're swearing by what the altar's for. If you're swearing by the temple, you're swearing by God's house and who lives there. If you swear by heaven, what are you swearing by? God on his throne.
But they did that so that they could make an oath so somebody who wasn't a Jew, especially, would believe that they were telling the truth and they were lying through their teeth.
Right. No, I understood completely, but Jesus uses that to point out their hypocrisy, utter hypocrisy. And so what we see is Jesus uses his last public discourse, because this is the last thing Jesus is going to say publicly. From here on out, it's going to be between he and his disciples, because we're now hours away, okay? Hours away from when Jesus is going to die, okay? And so what Jesus is doing, he's using his last public discourse to make a mockery of the Pharisees, of these men who are so celebrated and held up so high, rabbi in the marketplace, and, oh, your phylacteries are so beautiful. No. Jesus is saying these people are not worth the attention you're giving them. Lee.
Now, he is actually talking to them. They are in his presence.
He's in the temple.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
They're hearing everything he's saying.
Oh, absolutely. Why do you think they want to kill him? This is going to lead, I mean, this is hours before he is taken. This is the straw that breaks the camel's back. His last public discourse is the reason, one of the many reasons, why the Pharisees absolutely say, we're done. Go get it. He's going to die for the things he's been saying. So, and he holds nothing back here, okay? He holds nothing back. All right. This next question in our reading here is, what was Jesus talking about when discussing the cup and the dish? So we see he talks about this cup and the dish that they wash outwardly, but inwardly it's just filthy. And so what are we talking about?
That's what they were inside, is they were filthy, but on the outside they looked, tried to look good to people.
Yep. So the scribes and Pharisees read the law in their completeness. And on the outside, they looked spiritual, didn't they?
Pretty good.
Yeah. But they only abided by their traditions and what they thought the law meant to them. They were inwardly absolutely correct. And that's what he accuses them of. And Jesus warns about obeying the law of God, not the traditions of men. So what did Jesus mean by make one proselyte? And when I'm reading the wrong thing. I didn't advance my slide. That's what the problem is here. So Jesus, and this Jesus is telling the Pharisees that a pure spiritual life makes for clean outward conduct, and that's what we come to understand through the Word, is that if you want to have a clean outward appearance, it starts inside. Jesus said one of the hardest things to control is what?
The tongue,
right? Because out of your mouth comes all sorts of nastiness.
But both things.
Right. And so out of this physical place comes what's in your what?
Heart.
What's in your heart? What's in your spirit? So you display your inward appearance by how you control yourself and your outward look. And these Pharisees, they looked really good, but by their deeds, by what they would say, by their actions, they were horrible. They were so hypocritical. And the Pharisees' attempt to look outward, pure outwardly, was easily seen through because of how corrupt they were, because of how they treated others. And so those who just looked on the surface would see, oh, they're so pious and righteous. But you didn't have to dig very far to see just how corrupt and how hypocritical the Pharisees were. So what final accusation does Jesus land at the feet of the Pharisees? Towards the end of this?
Bearing witness against yourselves. What is it? Consequently, you bear witness against yourselves that you are the sons of those who murdered the prophets?
Right. Okay. So they are admitting descendants of those Jews who slew the prophets of old, and they are willing scourges of those who are sent to them by God. Those prophets who have been sent to them. What did they do to John?
Killed
they killed him.
I just
What did they do to Stephen?
They killed him.
How are they any better? They say, and Jesus says in here, you say that if we were there when where our fathers were, we would not have made those mistakes. Except they're making the exact same mistakes. They're killing the prophets who were sent to them. They don't believe what is being said to them. They don't believe Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus, who is fulfilling every messianic prophecy that was ever given in the flesh, they don't believe it. So how can they say that we wouldn't have killed the prophets like our fathers did if we had been there? Oh, had we been there, we would have been better than our fathers. No! You would have been probably worse. Because the next 50 years, as we're going to be reading in just a few sections here, is probably the worst that you will ever see on the earth. The worst treatment of people, the worst treatment of Jews especially, they're going to be abused and just absolutely sacrificed more than anybody in the history of the world. It's going to be horrible. All right, our next reading is Mark chapter 12, verses 41 through 44, and Luke chapter 21, verses 1 through 4. It's very short readings. And if you don't know what this is, just watch the slides on Sunday, because that's kind of the picture that I try to put up for the offering slide. Is this right here? Okay. This is the story we're reading. So in Mark chapter 12, verses 40, starting verse 41, it says, "And Jesus sat down opposite the treasury," so he's in the temple, as we discussed. So now he's outside the temple proper, in probably the portico, where Jews were allowed to be, women and men, to give their offering. Gentiles would still not be allowed here, but Jews would be allowed here. And he began watching how the people were putting money into the treasury. And many rich people were putting in large amounts, and a poor widow came and put in 2 lepta coins, which amount to a quadrine, and that doesn't matter. She had 2 pennies that amounted to 2 cents, right? To nothing. Calling his disciples to him, he said to them, "Truly, I say to you," and see, Jesus sees a teaching moment here, okay? And he takes an opportunity to teach his disciples this. "Truly, I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all the contributions to the treasury. For they all put in of their surplus, but she, out of her poverty, put in all that she owned, all that she had to live on." All right? So I put in here this is a quote from the author. He says, "It is said that in the court of women there were cloisters and porticos, and under the shelter of these were placed 13 chests, with trumpet-shaped mouths into which offerings might be dropped." So the money would just funnel down into the chests, right? "The money cast in was for the benefit of the temple. An inscription on each chest showed to which one of the 13 special items or cost or expenditure the contents would be devoted. As for the purchase of wood or gold or frankincense or temple offerings, those kind of things." So you could choose where you wanted your money to go even. They gave that opportunity, okay? So this is, of course, from Josephus. This is not scriptural. But I don't doubt that this is true, knowing how the Pharisees worked. I'm sure that this is the way it worked. You want to attract money in multiple different ways. And giving people the option of putting their money towards certain things in the temple would be attractive to more people than just putting it in a collective pot where the Pharisees determine what it goes to. So they gave people the opportunity to contribute to those different things that they wanted. So what does Jesus teach his disciples about giving while watching their contributions to the temple treasury?
It's more what comes from your heart than what...
Correct. You're dead on. It's the quality, not the quantity of what's given, that matters to God. God expects us to do what we can with what we have. God knows our hearts and knows our intentions. We must approach God with our offerings honestly and humbly, giving and doing what we can, right? God doesn't expect us to give more than we have. And we read about some churches that were trying to support those Christians in Jerusalem that gave more than they could afford to give. God doesn't expect that. God expects us to do what we can. And for some people, doing what we can is back labor, is giving of your time and giving of your means. For some people, that's giving money or giving funds. I fully expect that Paul probably gave monetarily, but what did he do? He collected those funds. He used his time and his effort to get those funds, preaching and teaching as he went, and bringing that back to Jerusalem. I wouldn't expect Paul to give what some of these churches were giving. I don't think that was not Paul's mission. His mission wasn't to give as much money as he could. His mission was to spread the word. So he was giving of himself as much as he could. And I think we can look at examples like that and see that God doesn't expect everybody to give money. God expects you to give what you can. God expects you to do what you can. For some people, that is money. But for others, it's other things. It's the work you do. It's giving of your time and giving of your means. It's being with those who are sick and afflicted, bringing meals to people. We have lots of different things that we do for our members here that show that it's not always about money. Carol.
And it's not just that she gave all that she had. It's that she knew that God would take care of her.
Right.
Even though she gave the 2 cents, that God would take care of her. And that's the entire difference out of the surplus, and that you make it about money, but it's really that she understood she'd been poor for a long time, and she goes, yeah, God will take care of me.
Right, exactly. And what do we know about this? She's a widow, right? So what do we know about widows? They're supposed to be supported by the church, right? They're supposed to be supported, or widows in that time were supposed to be supported by the temple, you know, whatever. They would be supported by God, okay? Specifically, we know in this age that those widows who qualify are supposed to be supported by the church, right? If they don't have family to take care of them, if they don't have relatives, and they can't support themselves, and they're devoting themselves to God, well, it falls on the church's shoulders to take care of them. So it falls on each and every member to help support that, right? We read this. And does anybody have any other comment about that?
I was just going to say that if we all had that same attitude, the church would probably be in a lot better shape.
I think the whole world would be in a lot better shape
yeah.
if we had that attitude. All right, so the next section is John 12, verses 20 through 50. This is about Greeks seeking Jesus. Well, I don't want to take the time to read this one here because I want to spend more time on some of the last couple of sections. But so I'm just going to ask the questions here. What did Greeks seeking Jesus signify?
That his word was open to everyone.
Okay. But Jesus told us specifically that he was there to tend the lost sheep, right?
Yeah.
That was his job. When he starts seeing Gentiles looking for Jesus, what does he say?
Go away. Go away, dogs.
No? No. What does he say in this reading here?
In this reading.
Specifically verse 33.
Says,
oh.
Signifying to what death he would die.
Oh, I'm sorry, verse 23.
Yeah, I was going to say, must be.
Verse 23, yes.
But Jesus answered them, the hour has not come that the Son of Man should be glorified.
The hour has come.
I'm sorry. I like to add words. No, I don't.
Gentile seeking Jesus is Jesus recognizing that his time on this earth is coming to an end. Okay? Because the word is spreading past the Jews. It's going to the nations. That wasn't Jesus' focus. Jesus' focus was to save the lost sheep. And once he had accomplished that, once he had fulfilled his mission, then what's left for Jesus to do?
Go back to heaven.
Fulfill his mission here, which is what?
Die.
die on the cross.
Which is sacrifice, salvation for everybody, right? Right. So Jesus recognizes that when he sees these Greeks coming to him, he tells his disciples, my time's at hand. Because the word of God has spread to the point where he needs to do what he had come to do. It's no longer about just saving the lost sheep. It's now about saving the entire world. And he cannot do that without the sacrifice. So he recognizes that the end of his ministry, his earthly ministry, is at hand. He was there to save the Jews. And now that the gospel has spread to the Gentiles, Jesus has just one thing left to do. And it is the hardest task that he has to face. His incarceration, torture, and death for all mankind. That's what he has to face in the next few hours. The next, probably within 24 hours. From where he is right now. What does Jesus mean by his conversation about grain? He talks about that grain seed in this reading.
The grain has to ripen. The thing has to die.
Okay.
And then
exactly.
Fall. So it's a time of ripening.
When you plant a grain seed, if it doesn't go on the ground, what happens to that grain seed?
It
rots, right? What comes from that grain seed?
Nothing.
If that grain is going to produce, what does it have to do necessarily? What's left of a potato? You know, you cut the potato up, you cut the eye off the potato, throw it in the ground. What's left of that once that plant grows and the potatoes start to be part of the roots? And what's left of that original potato that you put in the ground?
It's yucky.
There's nothing left of it, right? Can we effectively say it dies? What happens to that tomato seed you put in the ground?
Sometimes you'll see it again.
Do you ever see that tomato seed again?
Yeah.
Right. What happens to any fruit when you plant the seed in the ground?
It
grows. Right. But what happens to the seed?
Oh, it splits open.
Right. What happens to the seed itself? Is the seed any longer a seed?
No.
It has to die. In order for that seed to be effective, it has to die. And that's what Jesus says when he's talking to his disciples here. That grain seed, in order for it to be effective, has to die. In order for me to be effective, I have to die. I have to be raised up.
So it's the appropriate time, which is
the appropriate time.
Appropriate time to fall.
Right. And so he's at this point where in order for him to bring about life and the kingdom, he must die. As the grain seed must die to bring forth more fruit, Jesus must die to bring forth the fruit of eternal life for all mankind.
Oops.
What did Jesus ask for from his Father in this reading?
Ask that again, we were being.
What did Jesus ask for from his Father in this reading?
Glorify thy name.
Yeah.
Before that, just before that.
Save me from this hour.
Exactly. He's a human, right?
Yes.
Is he looking forward to being tortured and killed?
No.
Would any of you?
No.
What does he ask? What does he beg his Father for?
Let this cup pass from me.
But
your will be done.
Your will be done.
And then he says, save him from this coming hour of death, but if this hour has to happen, then let it happen. Did it have to happen?
Yes.
Absolutely. It's the whole purpose that he came for. He recognizes that. But as a human, does he want to face it?
No. That's verse 27.
Yeah, would any of us want to face what he had to endure?
No.
Absolutely not. None of us would invite that. And he didn't either. He was not looking forward to it, I guarantee it. But he understood it had to happen. And he recognized that his father's will needed to be done. And he said, "So, Father, glorify your name." And what did, how did God respond to that?
"I have most glorified it and will glorify it again."
All right. And that was just a whisper to Jesus, right?
No, that was a voice out of
heaven. A voice out of heaven that everybody heard. Yeah. And some people only heard it as thundering, right? Yeah. So this wasn't any small event that just happened.
And others said an angel has spoken.
So he recognized that God had spoken. What did he say about that?
"Divorce has not come for my sake, but for your sake."
Right. Jesus knew what he was there for. They did not. Jesus knew God's glory. They did not. They did not recognize God's glory at all. Otherwise, would they have rejected Jesus? No.
They thought he was going to be an earthly king. That whole time they thought, didn't they think he was going to be earthly?
Absolutely. Is that God's glory? Is God earthly?
No, no.
God is a spirit, right? And so Jesus getting them to recognize that God is a spirit and that, that what they're looking forward to is not earthly, spiritual, took him dying on the cross. There is no other way to get that through their thick skulls. None of his disciples wanted to hear him say that he was going to be raised up. But in these last few days, he said it multiple times.
They still didn't get it.
Oh, I'm sure by about this time they're probably starting to get it. And but what is their first instinct when they see it happening?
To run away,
right? To save their skins. When they're in the Garden of Gethsemane, how many of them go to trial with Jesus?
None.
None of them. Zero stand by his side. Peter follows. But denies him.
Yeah.
Denies that he even knows him.
Poor Peter.
The others don't even follow. They run for the hills. Because they know what's coming down. It's what Jesus told them was coming down. He is going to be tortured and then crucified. Our next reading is Matthew chapter 24. This is where we get into it. So this first part is Jesus talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. So let's read, I want to spend the reading on the last part, on the second part of Matthew chapter 24. So this first part of chapter 24 is pretty straightforward. What did Jesus tell his apostles would happen to the temple?
It would be destroyed in
3 days. Right. 3 days. Utterly destroyed. What did he say about that? Not one stone left on another. So, understanding that the foundation of the temple, some of it was bedrock, and some of it was granite stones that were 30 feet by 30 feet, okay? That's all that was left. The smaller stones that were maybe 10 feet by 6 feet by 8 feet that made up the bottom of the wall, gone. We're talking huge stones that were gone. All that was left was this big, what we would call the concrete slab, right? That's all that was left of the temple when the Romans got done with it. Everything else was utterly destroyed.
Yeah,
utterly.
Archaeologists, they're always digging for mm-hmm. things. This is exactly why I feel like they can't find it, because he utterly destroyed it. Like, that's
well,
why it's not
yeah, but you have to understand there's something standing on this right now. What's where the temple used to be right now?
That's
the Dome of the Rock.
Okay. Yeah,
the Dome of the Rock. Okay, the Muslim yeah. temple stands on where yeah. the Jewish temple used to be. Yeah. The Dome of the Rock is where that temple used to be. That's why that temple will never come again. God in his wisdom made sure that the only way that's going to happen is for the Jews to wipe out the Islamic nations. You know how big the Islamic nations are, right?
Yeah.
They're like 2 billion strong. They're not going to allow the Dome of the Rock to ever fall. God doesn't care. The Jewish temple means nothing to God anymore. It died in 70 AD for a purpose. That was the end of the age. God was saying, earthly temples no longer matter. Kingdom of God is spiritual. I don't care what's on the stones where the temple used to be, because it doesn't matter to God anymore. He doesn't need it. The Jews, as they once existed, no longer exist. No Jew can claim his heritage, because everything that was in the temple that gave you the heritage of the Jews back to Moses, like you could name Jesus' heritage, no longer exist. Those were all destroyed by the Romans. No Jew can claim that they are a Jew and say for sure they're a Jew and not some sort of Arabian descent. They can't.
They think they can.
If you ask a Jew what their heritage is, they'll say that I was born in Israel. They don't ever try to make claims about having Jewish heritage anymore. Because they can't. They can't prove it. I've had several friends who were Jews, and being a Jew to them had nothing to do with being able to claim that you were descended from Abraham and being able to prove it.
Just a culture.
How could they? Yeah. For a long time, when did this current Jewish nation exist again?
1949.
Before that, when the Romans destroyed them, for almost 2,000 years, the Jews weren't there. They were spread across the globe. It was the United States helping reestablish that Jewish nation that called that a Jewish nation. And it looks nothing like what it looked like before. Nothing. So, what signs did Jesus say would happen before this destruction? He gives some very specific signs that were going to occur.
The earthquakes and.
So we're going to start with false Christs proclaiming that the second coming was at hand or that it was here, right? Then the next would be wars and rumors of wars. Then earthquakes, famines, pestilence. Then persecutions of the saints. And then false prophets. And then once the gospel was preached to the whole world, and does that mean every corner of the globe? When we talk about the whole world in the New Testament, what are we talking about?
The known world.
Okay. So when we're talking about the known world, I would say all of what we consider the Middle East, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What we consider now Turkey, Italy, Rome. Paul even wanted to go to Spain, right? And then we see what kind of eunuch was that we studied several weeks ago?
Ethiopian.
So the word heading south past Egypt, right? Okay. But the known world at that time. Are we talking about North America? South America?
No.
Central America?
No.
Russia?
No.
Probably not. Talking about the known world at the time. If we were talking about the whole globe, would Paul have been forbidden to go into Northern Asia by the Holy Spirit? No. Paul hit those areas where he was supposed to go, right? The known world at the time. Okay. Those areas where the Holy Spirit knew that the word could be planted and would grow and flourish. Over time, the gospel has spread to the entire globe. But we're not talking about that in the first century. I don't think that happened in the first century. There's no way it could have gotten to North America in the first century. Were we making airplane trips over there? Regular boat rides? No. Those things weren't happening. So the idea that we're discussing the globe is a fallacy. That's not real. What we're discussing here is the known world. And the known world is those areas that where we see that the gospel went, where we're told that it went. when we see that the gospel reached as far north as even maybe Spain, I don't know, Paul didn't get there. He wanted to go there, but he didn't get there. And as far south as Ethiopia, I think that covers the gamut. I think that's the whole deal. So we're going to see that the gospel is going to be preached in the whole world before this destruction is going to happen. Jerusalem is going to be surrounded by armies. Right? He says, when you see that, it's happening. And when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel standing in the holy place, what are you supposed to do?
Run.
Run. Get out of there as fast as you possibly can, because what's about to happen is not something that you want to be part of. So what did Jesus tell them to do when they see these final things occur? Again, flee. Get out of there. It doesn't matter what you're doing. Don't go get your stuff. Don't go get your coat. Get out of there. The Lord gave the opportunity for there not to be a complete genocide of the Jews. Because if the Jews had gone to Jerusalem and fortified themselves, and was it going to stop the Romans?
No.
It took them 3 years. But they utterly destroyed the city. Wiped it off the face of the map. There was going to be nothing to stop Rome from conquering Jerusalem. That 70 AD invasion was horrific. Those people were sealed in that city for 3 years. Do you think that the walls of Jerusalem could contain enough food for people to be in there for 3 years?
That's why they were eating their babies.
They resorted to cannibalism. They were dying of hunger, resorted to cannibalism. They couldn't feed themselves. And they were being eaten. Once the wall came down, the Romans went in there and annihilated everybody. 1.some-odd million people, as counts were close to that, according to Josephus, died. 97,000, somewhere around that number, were taken captive. And what happened to those people that were taken captive? Josephus tells us that there weren't enough crosses for them to put bodies on. Okay? So they weren't put in jail. They were tortured and crucified. It was, like I said, some of the worst. And it's what Jesus said. This is going to be the worst that has ever happened on the face of the earth since the creation. The things that are going to come at the destruction of Jerusalem are going to signify the end of the age. And it's going to be the worst you'll ever see. I mean, we think that it's bad now. There's very little in our world that can compare to what happened to Jerusalem. When we think of war now, we think of bombs dropping, right? We think of missiles. We think of people getting killed. Nothing like a city that is utterly scraped off the map. We don't see that in the modern age. And I don't think we ever will. Because Jesus said this is the worst it's going to be. Worst it's ever been. So, just know that what those first century Christians went through, if they didn't follow what Christ said, was absolutely horrendous. It was horrible. And then, finally, Matthew chapter 24, verses 29 through 51. Some of the hardest things to understand. Our commentator calls this the second coming of Christ. And I don't disagree with them. If any of us were here for Larry's study of Revelation, he went through Matthew chapter 23, 24, and 25 with a fine-tooth comb, because I personally agree with many of the things that he said about that, because there are some statements in here that do not jive with Jesus talking about the second coming of Christ in clouds like the end of the beginning of eternity. That's not the picture that's spelled out here. And we'll look at those things. Let's read Matthew chapter 24, verses 29 through 51. So 29 through 35, if somebody can take that, and then 36 through 51, if somebody can take that.
But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall. And the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then the signs of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to another. How far?
35.
Now learn the parable of the fig tree. When its branches had already become tender and put forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. Even so, too, you, when you see all these things, realize that he is near, right at the door. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. The heaven and the earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away.
So, verse 34 kind of gives us the time definition for what's about to happen in verses 29 through 31. That sounds a lot like what we think in our minds as Christ returning on the clouds, right? I mean, isn't that what that says in verse 30? The Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory? Mm-hmm. When is that going to happen in verse 34?
Until all of these things have taken place.
Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. I don't know about you, but generation is not 2,000 years,
yeah,
or 5,000 years, or 10,000 years, or however long it's going to be before Christ returns. Generation was those people at that time. Everything we're talking about here in Matthew chapter 24, unless you try and explain your way around what is told to us very specifically two times in this reading, that it's happening right then, in that generation, you cannot say this is the second coming of Christ for eternity. Very specifically, I think what we're talking about is the end of the age. The second coming of Christ was wiping out, exactly as he said, Jerusalem. He had foretold those things were going to happen. And he gives the language here is very figurative, but if you apply it and you think about it to what was happening to Jerusalem in 70 AD, I'm sure a lot of this makes sense. Let's continue reading verses 36 through 51.
But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven or the Son, but the Father alone. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days which were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, and they were marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Then there shall be two men in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and one will be left. Therefore be on the alert, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming. But be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known at that time of the night the thief was coming, he would have been on alert and would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason, you be ready too, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. Who then is the faithful and the sensible slave whom his master put in charge of his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is the slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But if that evil slave says in his heart, my master is not coming for a long time, and shall begin to beat his fellow slaves and eat and drink with drunkards, the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour which he does not know.
and shall cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites. Weeping shall be there and the gnashing of teeth.
All right. So in this reading, immediately means what? Now.
Get ready.
This is not the end of everything that God created. If that's even what's going to happen when God returns, when Christ returns on the clouds. We have no idea what God's going to do with this universe. We have maybe an inkling if you read into what Peter says about fire, about the elements being destroyed with fire, the elemental things. Many people think that's talking about something else, not talking about the way this earth and the universe that we are occupied in will end. I have no idea what that's going to look like. I suspect in my heart of hearts that because Jesus holds all things together, if he stops doing that, what's going to happen to matter as we know? It won't exist. It'll be gone. I think that when God's ready to be done with this, it won't take more than a thought or a word, and it'll be done. So we don't have to worry about that, because what does he tell us? It's going to come like a what? You don't need to worry about it. It's not something you need to put on your anxiety list. Because when it happens, you're not going to have time to think about it. You're not going to have time to change your mind. You're not going to have time to run to the building and get baptized. The time is done. When God decides that time is done, that means there is no time. Time is over. God has ended time.
That's why we need to be prepared.
Exactly. That's why he talks about being prepared. Is this a prediction of the end of the world or the beginning of eternity? I don't think so. I think what he's talking about here is the end of the age. The end of the Mosaic age, the beginning of the Christian age. The two of them kind of melded together because when Christ died and was raised, did he establish the kingdom?
Not until the day of Pentecost.
Okay, right. But did it take 70 AD? The kingdom was established, right? When 70 AD rolled around. But 70 AD, the destruction of Jerusalem signified what?
End of the old Jewish age.
The end of the Jewish age. The end of the Mosaic Law age. The end of everything that stood for. Because the old covenant had been done away with. Jesus said that old covenant was coming to an end. And this new covenant was going to take its place. A more perfect covenant. A better covenant. We studied that in Hebrews, right? We studied what that new covenant was like and why the Jews were giving up on something that was about to end. They were giving up the new covenant, Christ, to go back to the old law. And they were just not even a decade away from seeing the end of what they were going back to. Paul, or the writer of Hebrews, was warning them, no, don't jump ship. That ship is almost completely underwater. You're standing on the flagpole. That's it. The rest of it is almost gone. Don't jump ship. You don't want to do that. You don't want to jump from this ship that is now fully erected, the kingdom of God, accepting new entries, as many as want to come on board, and jump back on that old ship that is almost underwater. You don't want to do that. Is this figurative language describing the end of the age? And I said, see verse 34, which tells us that these things would come to pass within this generation. This is a lot of figurative language that looks like the end of all things, right? Do you think this was the end of all things for those Jews at that time?
Yeah.
It was the end of everything they knew. It was the end of everything that they had been raised to know, to understand. The laws that they had written on their hearts, right?
And that's all they knew.
That's all they knew. Jesus had tried to give them a better way. He tried to draw as many of those lost sheep in as he could before he left. But to the Jews in 69 AD who were being married and given in marriage, mm-hmm. when this rolled around, it was the end of the world. As they knew it.
Yeah.
And it would never be the same again. Everything that they knew was gone. And then what does Jesus tell us about this end of age event starting in verse 36?
Nobody knows.
Does Jesus know?
No, not the Father.
Only the Father knew when that was going to happen. Jesus had no idea. And he admits he had no idea when this end of age would happen. If it would happen on Sabbath day. If it would happen on this day. He gave them several different warnings. Be prepared. Because you don't know when it's going to happen. I don't know when it's going to happen. Only the Father knows. I think Jesus on his throne, the Godhead Jesus, knows. But Jesus the man, no clue.
You know why he hasn't told us? Because he knows we can't handle it.
Well, I wouldn't want to know if it was going to be next Tuesday.
No. I don't want to know.
Or what if you're told that it's going to be 37 years, 3 days, and 2 months, two months and 3 days from now? How do you prepare for that?
Don't.
Well, I mean, we don't need to know those things. We really don't need to know.
We're supposed to live every day.
Right. If we had the hard date when the end of everything was going to happen, I think that would
be horrible.
It would make life so hard to live. It's better just to be prepared for every second of every day.
Yeah,
well, it would change the face of the earth forever.
Yeah.
We don't need to know that. We don't need to know. God is the only one who knows that, and that's the way it should be. It's his prerogative. It's his creation. Why do we need to know when he's going to end it? We need to live our life as if every day is our last. And I know you've heard that before. But every day... does it really matter if it's the end of the world or if it's just the end of the world for you? It doesn't really matter. So we need to live every day like we're living our last day. Because you never know. Right? All right, that ends on what we had to study tonight. I didn't get my slide up for next week, but the syllabus, let me pull it up here real quick. It's going to be week 21, so this will be the parable of the virgins and talents. Jesus predicts his death.
Acts or whatever.
Prep for Passover. Jesus washes the disciples' feet. And Judas' betrayal and Peter's denial foretold.
Are you teaching next week?
No. It's Leinster.
John.
Lenny's guy.
Well, right.